Well, man, what a gift. What a gift that was. Thanks, Adam, Melissa. That was incredible. This is one of those moments where I'm tempted as a teacher, a preacher, to get up and say, you know what? Let's just be dismissed. That was great. That was really, really great. Well, my name is Jason Malik, and if you haven't been with us, we are in the midst of a series called Summer with the Sages. And we're talking about the big idea of wisdom, as you heard. We're talking about wisdom and parenting, and there have been lots and lots of different angles by which we can evaluate how to be wise, how to live wisely, how to ask great wise questions. Last week, if you were here, I kind of introduced that concept of questions, asking wise questions, and why oftentimes in our culture we fail to do that, even though the sages through the ages have demonstrated time and again that question asking is one of the, if not the most important critical aspects of being wise. We took a look at a number of different characters. King David from the Old Testament, around 1000 BC. Then we kind of accelerated 500 years and looked at a non-Judeo-Christian character, Plato, one of the greatest philosophers to ever live. And then finally culminated with Jesus, who, if I were to ask you what Jesus stands for, what he's all about, what he's best known for, my guess is question asking would not be the first thing you think of. Wouldn't be the first thing you say, you know. What's Jesus great at? Question asking. And yet, as I kind of studied, my guess is as we started to unpack who Jesus is, we realized he asked over 300 questions, which is documented in just 3 years of his life in the New Testament. 300 questions. He was an amazing, maybe the master of question asking. And so I kind of concluded with, if Jesus is kind of the model for our lives, or if you consider yourself a follower of Jesus, then maybe we need to be better question askers. I kind of contrasted that with asking the question, why in the world is question asking so difficult? Why is it not more a part of our culture? Why in our school systems do we reward people for having great answers but not necessarily great questions? Richard Rohr, a Catholic theologian, he attempts to answer that a little bit in a somewhat humbling quote. We'll put this on screen for you. Richard Rohr says this, maybe answers give us more of a feeling, there we go, maybe answers give us more of a feeling of success and closure. Easy answers instead of hard questions allow us to try to change others instead of allowing God to change us. Easy answers instead of hard questions allow us to change others rather than allowing God or inviting God to change us. That's a pretty humbling quote. And yet I think as we look to be followers, faithful followers of Jesus on mission to become more like him, we need to be willing to ask questions of ourselves, of others, and of God. And so this week I challenged all of us to become better question askers in those three categories of ourselves, asking ourselves, why am I emotional about this? Why did I just make that decision and not that? And really ask ourselves some deep questions about our identity and our character. I also invited us to ask questions of others, because oftentimes I know I, as an extrovert, I find myself just kind of talking a lot. And yet I find that the most attractive people in my life are those that ask faithful questions, good, intriguing questions of me. And my guess is you find that to be true as well. And then I also invited us to ask questions of God. You see, God's not afraid of our fears, of our doubts, of our questions, of our longings. God, in fact, craves those deep relationship through inviting questions. And even though we may not hear audible answers, over time, beginning to see how God answers those questions. Hopefully that was a good exercise over the course of this week. So let me ask the question of you. If question asking is so important, specifically as it relates to kind of faith or religion, is that all we're to do? I mean, are we just supposed to go around asking questions and answers are off limits? Well, hopefully you know the answer to that is no. We need to be able to provide good answers to questions, both of ourselves, to others, and to God. But how do we go about doing that? That's the subject of what we're going to talk about this morning, taking a look at a couple of fun passages. But before we do, I wanted to look at a couple of ways kids have answered questions. You may have seen some of these. These are our children who have answered questions on tests, and these are some really, really bright kids. So let's take a look at a couple of these. On test scores, teachers have obviously kind of given us insight as to how kids answer questions. So look at the first image. What ended in 1896? Well, 1895, of course. How about the next one? The quadrilateral perimeter. Name the quadrilateral. Bob, Sam, Tedeson, Kate, Harry. How about another one? Extra credit. What is the strongest force on earth? Love. You got to love that kid, right? You want to meet that person who wrote that. How about this? Write an example of a risk. Oh, this. Period. Write an example of a risk. Number five. Briefly explain what hard water is. Duh. Ice. Right? Sorry, that's not going to pass. Another one. I earn money at home by, well, I don't. I'm a freeloader. You got to love the honesty of this. JP, don't get any ideas. How about this? Find X. Well, here it is. How do you debate that, right? You got to give that person credit for answering the question. A couple others. What was where was the American or Declaration of Independence signed? At the bottom, of course. That's funny. The cause. Tony practices the piano 20 minutes every day. The effect? He's a big nerd. My daughter loves piano, so I'm glad she's not here. That's not true. And lastly, how about this? The first cells were probably lonely. You got to love that. So kids, you know, they very, very quickly learn how to answer questions. And again, 10 examples of kids who answered very, very cleverly. Some would say smart alecky, perhaps. And yet they were answering the question. I guess I'd ask, if that's not the way to answer questions or to engage with important questions, what is? So let's dive into those. And what might this look like in our lives? I know I, as I mentioned, as an extrovert, I love to talk and talk. So whenever I hear questions, I love to just chat. In fact, I chat to the point where probably I'm not answering the question. A good friend of mine just told me a story. He joined an organization about a year ago, and he sat with one of the employees of the organization. He was just trying to get to know, so he's meeting with five or 10 different people and asking questions about what they do and, you know, what makes them successful, how can we work effectively together. He told me this story. He said he sat with one of the highest level people in the organization, and he said, "What do we do? Like, describe to me, what is kind of the mission? What's the purpose? How do we go about achieving what we do?" He said the kind of EVP person sat with him for 90 minutes and talked and talked and talked, and he was less clear on what he did or what they were to do than he was when he asked the question. You see, we oftentimes talk and talk and talk and sometimes don't effectively answer the question. So if that's not the case, how do we go about answering questions? See, then there are people who simply avoid questions. I know folks, and perhaps you're like this or know people like this, who just, they don't want to deal with questions. They're really, really pleasant to be around, incredible friends. But you know what? When some kind of question or even contention comes up, they make a beeline for the door or another room. You've seen those kind of people, right? So if it's not kind of talking unnecessarily, if it's not kind of avoiding the question, what is it? And then we get to questions of faith. These are deep, deep questions, hard ones. In fact, what are the two topics that we cannot talk about at cocktail parties? Politics and religion. Why is that the case? Why can we not talk about those? See, I wonder if we people of faith, and this is all faith, if we people of faith have done an ineffective job answering questions, if we haven't answered them in a wise, in a humble, in a gentle way. And if that's the case, of course you can't talk about it. And yet I'd want to pose back to us, what do we do with that? You see, A.W. Tozer said years ago in a beautiful book about his relationship with God, he said, the most important thing about a person is what we believe about God. And if that's the case, we should be able to talk about faith, have questions of God, have questions of one another, have questions of ourselves, but then be able to answer those. And so we're going to take a look at a passage that hopefully helps to answer, how do we go about addressing questions? If you have a Bible, you're welcome to turn. It's in the Bibles in front of you. It's on page 851. We're going to turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. It's right near the end of the New Testament. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Let me give you a little context to this passage. So Peter was somebody who had had intimate encounters, unbelievable experiences with Jesus, and so much so that he became his Lord and his Messiah. Now, Peter wrote to a bunch of people all around the regions in which he traveled to encourage them, to challenge them, to equip and to educate them. This is one of those circumstances. It's called an epistle, but it's literally a letter that Peter wrote to a group of early Jesus followers. Now, in this time period, Jesus' followers, perhaps not unlike today, had lots of maybe persecution. They weren't able to express their faith in a public forum, at least without being kind of ridiculed or maybe alienated. And so this is one of those circumstances where Peter's reaching out to this small community of Jesus' followers, and he's trying to equip them, and he says this, "But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect." So again, put yourself in the mindset of an early Jesus follower. These were people who had to largely live underground with their faith. They weren't allowed to kind of go public with it. And Peter addresses them and says this, "In your hearts revere Christ as Lord." Well, how do you go about doing that, Peter? Well, here's how you do it. You are always to be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. You see, I think these early Jesus followers lived in a time not unlike us. I don't know about you, but I don't feel terribly comfortable talking about my faith in a very public setting, in a public forum. When I go to a cocktail party or any kind of party, it's not the first thing on my mind. Even though I can stand up here and talk in front of you, you guys came to a church. But in my business environment, in my neighborhood, how do we go about giving an answer to the questions posed to us? I think Peter gives us some hints. Let's kind of unpack this passage, almost working in reverse. Here's what I love about this. Peter says, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. What is he inferring in this? He's inferring that we have been asked, what? A question, right? We've been asked a question. What's the question? The question is this, why do you have hope? Why do you have hope? I think the very first principle we can extract out of this passage is Peter is highlighting that you are a person of hope. The question I ask of myself is, do I live with hope? Do I live in such a way that those people around me are so impressed with how I live in the midst of my circumstances, whether under persecution or in times of peace? Do people come to me and say, there is something about you. You have hope. What is that about you? Would you tell me? Do you live in such a way that people come to you and say, what is that hope? That's a pretty tough question for me, because there are seasons in my life when I think I live full of hope, full of joy, full of peace, full of love. Then there are times when I don't. And I think a litmus test is, are people coming to me and saying, what is that in you? They come to us and they say, tell me what that is deep within your heart. Tell me, I want that. See, there's hope. And Peter says, when people come to you and ask, what is that? Give me the reason for the hope that's within you. Peter says, then you have an invitation to share. So a couple of principles. We live as people of hope, and we're invited to respond. We live as people of hope, and we're invited to respond. You see, oftentimes, when people ask me questions about faith, or we get into conversations about faith, I sometimes go to my trusty big green sleeping pill. This book is written by Millard Erickson. It was written about 20 or 30 years ago. It's called Christian Theology. Monster. I went to graduate school and read this book, believe it or not. Literally called it the Big Green Sleeping Pill because I'd sit in the library and would fall asleep. So when people ask me questions, is this the way to respond? Well, let me tell you about the theological term called justification. Or how about adoption or regeneration, sanctification, glorification, perseverance, and on and on and on. Let me memorize some of the Big Green Sleeping Pill to share with you the reason for the hope that I have. Is that it? Oftentimes not. Now, there may be times to refer to the Big Green Sleeping Pill, but when somebody asks me for the reason for the hope that's within me, that's probably not it. Well, if that's not it, are we to kind of beat them up with our amazing arguments? Are we to, you know, memorize all of this rich theology? One of my old friends used to say, in my relationship with people, I've been told that I like to wear people down to a bloody nub. I can wear people down to a bloody nub. Stephen knows who I'm talking about, a dear friend of ours. He's an incredible guy, but he can argue people down to a bloody nub to the point where they finally say, I give, uncle, I don't even want to talk about this anymore. I'm not sure I fully believe, but it's beyond my comprehension. Is that how we're supposed to respond to questions? Or how about a third way? I mean, maybe we just avoid it altogether. I mean, questions are kind of contentious, and maybe we should just kind of redirect or shift another way or wait till another time. No, Peter says we are to give an answer for the reason for the hope that is within us. In other words, it's not about wearing somebody down to a bloody nub. It's not necessarily about memorizing rich and detailed, sophisticated theological systems. It's not about avoiding. So if that's the case, how do we go about giving a reason for the hope that's within us? I think Peter gives us a little bit of a verbal cue in this. He says this. Let's read that passage once more. In your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. Give a reason for the hope that you have. In other words, you have a hope, I have a hope, we have a hope within us that nobody can contradict. Nobody can contradict. I think what Peter is saying here is you and I have a story to tell about our faith. You may not have faith totally worked out, but every single person here, I gotta believe, has questions and interaction with God in ways that it will tell a story. I think what Peter is saying is share your story. Share your story with people, all of its brokenness and beauty and harmony and discord, all of the roller coaster rides that you've been through. Share your story. The hope that is within you, the hope that you have, share your story. It's not necessarily about sophisticated theological arguments. That may come in time. It's not about wearing somebody down to a bloody nub. It's not about avoiding. Share the story that you have. But here's the cool thing. I love that Peter includes this because very often I hear this passage quoted and that last little phrase is dropped off. He says, do it with gentleness and respect. You see, how often have you seen, heard, or maybe even been responsible for people who don't share their faith, who don't answer questions with gentleness and respect? I wonder if that's the reason that religion, that faith, our personal faith, is something that we cannot talk about because we haven't shared with gentleness and respect. I think we have a great example in another passage of the Bible. If you're kind of a Bible study reader, this may be a passage that you're familiar with. It comes from Acts chapter 17. And it kind of recounts the story of the beginning of the church. So you can imagine that Jesus is gone. The church is trying to figure out what they believe, why they believe, how to interact with the world. And Paul, the apostle, is a guy who walks around telling people about Jesus. But he does it in a way that he embodies what Peter talks about. He shares the reason for the hope that he has by sharing his story. In Acts chapter 17, we see a beautiful depiction of this. Acts chapter 17 and it's verses 19 to 23. Paul has gone to Athens, Greece. And if you know much about the ancient world, Athens, Greece was a thriving metropolis, an environment with ideas, rich ideas, tons and tons of learning. And people would walk around and debate and interact and argue and talk and teach and learn. It was an amazing context, amazing setting. And so Paul comes into Athens and his heart is grieved. His heart is grieved because he sees these people that are so desperate for God, and yet they're longing. And in many ways, hopeless. And so he begins to interact with them in the courtyards and different places and public settings. And they're so intrigued by what he says. Here's how the book of Acts recounts it. He said they, kind of the leaders, took him, Paul, and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean. After all the Athenians and foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas." You see, I think Paul, over time, now the text doesn't necessarily say this, but the only reason that these leaders would bring him to the Areopagus, kind of maybe the center stage for debate, for learning, for teaching, they brought him to the Areopagus because he had earned their trust. They wouldn't have done it otherwise. Yes, he was sharing ideas, but he had shared his story and the hope that was within him. The passage goes on. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and says this, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you're ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I am going to proclaim to you." You see, Paul didn't walk around and teach people uninvited. Paul was invited by the leaders to come, to debate, to interact. And only when asked, he shared. And when he did, he respected the people. He honored them. He said, "Look, I see that you're religious. I have tremendous respect for that. But your religion doesn't really seem to point anywhere. Can I help you with that? Let me share with you the reason for the hope that's within me." And if you continue reading the rest of the book of Acts, Paul does it time and again, shares his story and how Jesus had interacted and changed his heart and ultimately changed the world. It's an amazing depiction. So here's what I think we can learn from Paul. One, he's living in a way that's attractive, that's hopeful. So much so that the people say, "We want to know more." And when someone asks about his lifestyle, Paul obliges. He shares. And lastly, in his answer, he's gentle and respectful. Here's kind of some applications for us. What can we learn? Number one, live with hope. Live with hope. Our world is desperate for hope. Our world is desperate for joy, for peace, for patience, for love. Live with hope. And if you and I can live with hope, I guarantee the world is going to be attracted to that. Your friends, neighbors, coworkers, they will be so attracted if you and I can live with hope. Number two, this starts to get a little personal to me, answer only when asked. You see, too often, especially as kind of a church guy, I get real excited about my faith and I just want to go and broadcast that around the world. And I know that God can use that. I realize that. But what I've realized, and I think what Peter admonishes us with, is we answer, but only when asked, when invited to provide an answer. Number three, understand the question. This, I think we can take a cue from Jesus, because Jesus, I mentioned last week, he was asked 183 questions, I'm told. 183 questions. You know how many he answered directly? Three. Less than 2% of the questions Jesus was asked, he answered directly. You know why? Because I think he wants to get to the heart of the question before answering the question. Too often, I think we can address the question without really thinking about, without really probing into, is that really the question? Is that really the issue? So I think a third thing we can learn is to understand the question. And of course, the last one is this. We need to be gentle and respectful in however we answer questions about faith. Not with a hammer, but over a cup of coffee. Hanging out with a friend, somebody who's trusted, with whom we've earned respect. We need to be gentle and respectful. Years ago, I was in a small group environment with a group of folks, and we were talking about faith, and we tried to create a very kind of open context, open forum for people to ask their questions. And we weren't kind of the Bible answer men and women. We were simply trying to create a platform for people to be themselves, to present answers or questions that they'd had in a safe setting. But we kind of launched this group by inviting people to tell their stories. And I remember one guy, a couple of people had told theirs. I remember one guy, we got to him and he was kind of visibly uncomfortable, as, you know, is often the case. We talk about religion among other people. It gets a little awkward. He said, when he started out, he said, "You know what? I've never told my story before." And as he began to unpack his story, it was this beautiful and rich tapestry that God had woven into his life. He had never told his story before. Wouldn't it be great for you and I to invite people to tell their stories and for us to be confident in providing an answer and the reason for the hope that we have? I think we can do that by telling our stories and setting the table, inviting people to tell their stories and allowing God to do what God does. I think that's what Peter is encouraging us to do. So I hope that you and I can not only become great question askers of ourselves, of God, and of others, but I hope that we can be confident in providing an answer for the reason, for the hope that's within us. Will you bow your head and pray with me? Dear God, thank you for Peter, for the early Christians, those who suffered tremendously, those who maybe were just trying to work out their faith, didn't know quite what they believed. God, thank you for Peter's encouragement, his challenge, his admonishment to us to always be prepared to give an answer for the reason, for the hope that's within us. I pray that you would help us to discover our stories, be confident in the stories that you're writing. And God, I pray that you would do a good work. This is about you, not about us. Not directing our attention towards us, but directing it towards you. Thank you, God. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.